I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
JBR Capital has sponsored the Intercooler podcast for several months now. You've probably heard me talk about the company before. In that time, I've come to really understand what it is that makes JBR Capital different to other car finance companies. If I had to boil it down to one thing, I'd say it's this. Car finance is all JBR Capital does. Might sound like a minor detail, that, but in fact, it's really important. It means JBR Capital has a profound understanding of the car marketplace and of car buyers, an understanding that other finance companies could only hope to have. In fact, that very focused approach is exactly why the company was started in the first place. We recently had Darren Selig, founder of JBR Capital, on the podcast, episode 106, if you want to go back and listen. And he explained that he started the company when he realized that general finance lenders actually didn't understand cars or car buyers particularly well at all. So he spotted that gap in the market and he founded JBR Capital to fill it. So before you buy your next car, be it a supercar, sports car, classic car, a hypercar, or a luxury car, even if it's a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. And it really helps us if you tell them that the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Welcome to the Intercooler podcast.
Welcome to episode 121 of the podcast, everybody. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you here. Andrew, it's a busy episode, but the sort of bulk of this episode of the podcast is all about £20,000 cars. My theory being, whatever kind of car you want, sort of within reason, you don't need to spend more than 20k. Can we stand that up in any way? Or is that still too strict a budget, do you think?
Well, no, I think if you're not being ridiculous about it, no, I think there is a type of car from pretty more. We'll go through the genres, won't we? Can you buy a sensible supercar which isn't going to bleed you white for 20k? Probably not.
I couldn't come up with anything sort of exotic Italian mid-engine. Those days are gone, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, they used to be able to do it. I can remember. Not that long ago, you could buy a front-engine V12 Ferrari for 10 grand. It would be an automatic 400 and it would be appalling and it would cost you, you know, the shirt of your back to look after it. But you could do it. I don't think you can anymore.
Okay, so that stuff is off the table. But, you know, I've been having a trawl through the classifieds. I think you've done the same. And it is actually amazing what you can come up with for 20K. Yeah. Now,
what's the better? You and I have come up with exactly the same cars.
Probably there'll be some overlap, I'm sure. Of course, there are some realities that we need to have a think about, but we'll come on to those. As I said, there's an awful lot to get through. Let's talk Hungarian Grand Prix briefly. It's not the midway point of the season.
I bang my head against a wall. I just...
Scuderia fanboy.
I think they had the quickest car out there. I mean, George on pole was unbelievable. A massive congratulations to him. But as we know, he is Mr. Saturday. He can just pull it out of the bag over a lap. But I think they had the quickest car. They've definitely got the best driver lineup. Well, first of all, you know, Max, I mean, like him or hate him, my goodness, he did a good job, didn't he? And also, that's the other thing, is Max won that reason for the exact reason that Ferrari didn't, which was just teamwork. They just got all the calls right, didn't they? And yeah. I could just remember when it was in the bag, and Charles came into the pits, and somebody said, they're putting hard tyres on. Despite the fact the Alpines had already been out there, proving to the entire world that those tyres just didn't work. And like when Brundle was sort of saying, well, maybe they've got a load more downforce and they'll be able to switch them on and away. And he didn't sound convinced, and he was right not to be, because, oh, it's so frustrating. Because, I mean, two things. One is, as you know, I love the Ferrari race team and I want to see it winning. But also, Max is 60 points ahead now. 60 points.
It's 80.
80?
Yeah, it's 80 points.
And the real problem with that is you're going to get to the stage. You may already be there. Where Ferrari just go, we better just focus on next year's car. There's no point, you know, in these budget cap days of just spending all this resource and doing all this stuff, fighting a battle that's already lost. At which stage, you know, Max runs away from it and it's all done by Austin or something. And, you know, having had such a season last year, for this one to be such a damp script, despite the fact it's had so much potential. Ugh. Anyway.
So what did we say last week after the French Grand Prix? We said, Charles and Ferrari, not one more slip-up, one more driving error, not one more strategic blunder, not one more divid team order. Mm. They have to be absolutely on their A-game from here to the final race of the season to stand a chance. Next time out, they drop the ball in the most hopeless way, actually. And think about how it was set up after qualifying. Ferrari, second and third. And guess what? The Red Bulls were way back, Max in 10th. They Paris had this amazing 11th. Opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had Ferrari had this amazing opportunity to massively outscore, win the race for one thing, massively outscore their title rivals. And instead, the opposite happened.
It should have been a Ferrari 1-2.
No doubt.
If you'd given that, if you'd fed all the data into a computer before the race, and on balance of probabilities, presuming nobody stuffs it up, what's going to happen? It would say probably Leclerc wins it, followed by Carlos, and then it would start umming and erring, and it'd be one of Max, Lewis or George next.
Yep. Yeah, and so, you know, if that's what they come up with after starting second and third with their title rivals way back, I'm afraid they just don't have it in them this season. I think it's
they're not a team. They are not a team, and I think if this season has proven anything is that, I said this before on the podcast probably last weekend, you have to have, it's not enough, is it, to have, you know, the fastest car out there, which they have, you know, one of the top, certainly top three drivers out there, probably two of the top five drivers out there. They've got all the raw material. But if you keep on, I'm about to massively mix my metaphors here, but if you keep on, you know, sort of overcooking it or putting them together wrong or whatever, it doesn't matter, does it? Mm. It's not what you've got, it's what you do with it.
Yeah, I just don't think they're ready. I think this car was competitive a year too soon. And sadly, as you've pointed out before, the Mercedes is coming on, isn't it?
Mercedes have always gone well at Hungary.
True.
I mean, Lewis has been freakishly good at Hungary, even by his standards. So I'm not reading, you know, if they're that quick at Spa, then yeah, that'll be amazing.
So what odds then on Mercedes beating Ferrari to second in the constructors? Now, as you say, Ferrari have had a difficult run. Hungary is a bit of a circuit with a distinct character, so we mustn't read too much into it. But the way the trajectories are looking at the moment, it does seem as though there's only 30 points between Ferrari and Mercedes. And
that's ridiculous. That's absolutely. You think of that Mercedes at the beginning of the season, it looked undrivable, didn't it?
Horrible. You
know, the drivers complaining about spinal compressions. It was leaping around like a bloody pogo stick. And Ferrari had the quickest car out there. Well, arguably, certainly, you know, either the quickest or the next quickest car out there. And yet they're 30 points apart. So, you know, drop the ball one more time and Mercedes will be second in the constructors. That is, at, you know, well past the halfway point of the season.
Yeah.
How have they allowed that to happen?
Just to, so one last comment on this situation. Leclerc's last eight results, okay, so starting with the Spanish Grand Prix, and this is the bloke who's supposed to be in contention for the Drivers' World Championship. He is still second. So from Spain, DNF, fourth, DNF, fifth, fourth, first, Austria, DNF, sixth. That is not a title-running, title-winning run, is it?
Nor even close.
Dearing me. Nor even close, no. I think it's well and truly gone now, which is a shame, but there we go. I mean, yeah. Red Bull and Max have been pretty imperious, haven't they? So there we go.
Well, what Red Bull and Max are doing, they have now started to do what Mercedes have been so good at doing in the past, which is to win races they shouldn't be winning.
Mm.
And to, you know, obviously deploy Max to the best and everything else, but also, you know, Max can't do it on his own. And... you know, he didn't get fastest lap. You know, he probably wasn't the fastest car out there yesterday, but they just got it together. They work so well as a team, which is what Mercedes has always done. And you get what you get. And if you don't do that, as Ferrari found out, you get what you get there too.
Do you think George Russell is wondering how he finished behind Lewis, having started on pole, Lewis back in seventh?
I think Lewis was on a bat. I mean, I don't think that, I mean, there was a stint, wasn't there, where Lewis was just flying in the middle of the race and he got fastest lap. They were on different strategies, maybe, but I think there's enough doubt in there in terms of the different strategies for George to be able to rationalize it in terms of Lewis got the better rub of the green on that particular occasion. If it keeps on happening, then yeah, he will worry. But actually, if you look at their heads-to-heads in terms of either qualifying or race results throughout the course of the season, they're pretty even.
Yeah.
Which in itself, you know, given this is Lewis Hamilton we're talking about, you know, an eight-time world champion in a team that had been built up completely around him, the fact that George is, you know, even on, you know, level pegging with him, I think speaks volumes to the lad. I really do. I think he's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, it is remarkable. We'll see how it pans out over the latter part of the season. We must also mention Sebastian Vettel, who before the Hungarian Grand Prix rather surprised us all, I think, by announcing his retirement. I was surprised anyway.
I think his team were quite surprised too.
I think they probably were, yeah. I suspect most people assumed he'd give it another year or two to see if he can bring this project to fruition, the Aston Martin project to fruition, but instead, he's calling it a day, and I mean, who can blame him? His glory days are well behind him now. It's a long old while since he won, or he's been in contention for a race win. And he's achieved so much. He's earned an awful lot of money. You know, he's raced through different eras of the sport. Nothing left to prove, perhaps.
No, but he's, you know, I should look this up. I don't know how old he is. You probably do, but he's still
35.
He's 35, so he's still, you know, some years younger than Lewis.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, I mean, my worry for him is that people will look at his post-Red Bull performance.
Yeah.
The fact that he was, on at least two occasions, comprehensively outpaced by his younger teammate, and they'll go, well, those four world championships, that was more the Red Bull than its driver. Mm. I don't think that's fair. I think he clearly did have the best car on the track for those four seasons. And boy, he made the most of it, didn't he? But the moment that was taken away from him, you know, it's kind of, you can see why people sort of, you know, add two and two and conclude that he was, you know, one of the more quadruple world champions. I think that in his pomp, he was actually better than that. But I think he's, you know, I think he's just a sensitive bloke. And I think everything had to be right around him. And then, you know, when it wasn't, you know, even when you had the best cars, you did at times at Ferrari, it just didn't go his way, did it? More often than not, because he dropped the ball. So, you know, you have to be, again, it just goes back to being, you know, you don't just need the complete package as a team. You need to be the complete package as a driver. And if you look at Lewis, you know, what has been absolutely extraordinary about you, Lewis, over all these years is the consistency. And it's the way that he is mentally so tough. And all those, you know, wheel-to-wheel battles, which he had particularly with, you know, with guys like Rosberg and that sort of thing, he always came out on top, didn't he?
Yeah.
And if there was a coming together, it was always the other bloke's fault, or almost always the other bloke's fault. And that mental resilience is, I think, the reason why, you know, Lewis has, you know, twice as many titles as Seb. I'll be sorry to see him go, because, I mean, he's also turned into a fantastic sort of elder statesman for the sport as well, hasn't he? And, you know, he's been quite outspoken, quite rightly so, on a number of important things. And I think that even though he's no longer in a front-running car, I think he qualified like 17th or 18th at the weekend, which is sad to see. I still think he was a great force for good within the sport. And I just hope we haven't seen the back of him.
Yeah, he's grown into a really likeable character and someone you have to respect enormously. We'll be sad to see him go, but he's achieved so much. Congratulations on a fantastic career, Seb. He wants to go and spend more time with his family, and who can begrudge him that? I mean, enjoy it. Right, let's quickly run through some of the brilliant articles that we've been posting, if I may say so, on the Intercooler website and app. I just want to... It's worth talking about some of this stuff because there's been real variety up there. We've got some had some great contributions from our brilliant team of writers.
If I could briefly interrupt, I think the other reason we're going to talk about this is just that, you know, we want you guys to know about the website. Goodness knows, Dan and I and a few others have spent enough time getting it all together. And, you know, we hope that if you go and check it out at the-intercooler.com, you'll like it. It's, you know, it's not like any other car website. It hasn't, you know, got pages and pages and pages of the latest crossover hybrid SUV things. It's just, what have we got? You know, it's over 1,000 stories. It's over 1 million words from, you know, the finest writers in the business across a fantastically wide range of topics, so easily searchable. And, you know, I sound like I'm doing a massive promo for my own business, which of course I am, but I, you know, genuinely we are passionate about it. And, you know, people who tune into this, you know, we think the same sort of way that we do. And it just might be worth, you know, a minute of your time, just going to have a look. And, you know, you might like what you see. Sorry,
indeed.
I'll shut up now.
No, well said. And you'll find a link in the description of this episode. And if you're new to us, you can go and start a free trial, 1 month free trial, see if you like it or not. We think you will, and we think you'll stay with us. But go and do that now. So just some recent stuff that kind of... These two, they're both your pieces, actually, but they demonstrate the breadth. You drove the Aston Martin DBX 707 and really rather liked it. And you also wrote about...
I really liked it for a turn a bit ton SUV, which I wouldn't say is my favourite genre of car. But, yeah, I mean, well, go read the story. But, yes, it's you know, you think 700 horsepower Aston Martin SUV, you think this thing's just going to be, what do they call it, a brute in a suit. And it's just not. It's actually, it's a quite a subtle, very sophisticated and quietly impressive way of doing that kind of car. So, yeah, it's all there on the app.
You then wrote about Daytona 67, and I knew about Daytona 67, but I'd never really thought about the context, and you explained it beautifully. You know, Ferrari got mullered at Le Mans by Ford in 1966.
As we all know from the film.
And you make the point that there is this assumption out there, or an understanding, that was the end of Ferrari in sports car racing. Ford came and gave them a shoeing, and then dominated from there on in. Actually, it's not the case, because the very next time they went head-to-head, it was Ferrari that gave Ford a shoeing.
And it was in America, so it was on Ford home soil. And, you know, and in many ways, no, not in many ways, in every way, what Ferrari did to Ford in America was actually far more impressive than what Ford did to Ferrari in France. You know, two works Ferraris with 4-litre engines up against six works Fords with 7-litre engines. And they not only came first and second, but one of their customers came third. And only one of the Fords finished way down. I just don't think that people appreciate that. And Ferrari went on to win the World Sports Car Championship that year. So, you know, it's just a bit of context, isn't it? But it was, you know, I always thought that when they made that film, Ford versus Ferrari or Le Mans 66, depending on where you're watching it, that they chose the wrong race. That actually Le Mans 65 was a far more interesting race, but Ford didn't win it. So, you know, that's probably the reason. But also, Daytona 67 was a far more interesting race, with a far better backstory, far greater context to it. So, yeah, I just thought that I'd try and readdress the balance a little bit.
So sticking up with the motorsport theme, we then published a piece by Dr. Otto Lappi. Now, that name may well not be familiar to you. Dr. Otto Lappi, he's a cognitive scientist, a Finnish cognitive scientist. And with Alan Dove, he's produced a book called The Racer's Brain, which is all about what goes on inside the mind of an elite-level racing driver when he or she is in the car. Now, this is, we wanted to publish this piece because what we want to do with TI is surprise you and publish stuff that you probably wouldn't find in other magazines or websites. We want to do stuff that's a bit different. And this is that. This is Dr. Otto Lappi explaining what goes on inside the brain of a racing driver during a qualifying lap. And he's a cognitive scientist, so he's an authority on this matter, understands it implicitly. But between him and Alan Dove, they explain it in a very relatable way as well. So go and check that out. It's just an interesting insight into the psychology of a racing driver. It's brilliant.
I mean, he's a proper bloke, isn't he? He's, you know, he teaches at Helsinki University. He's a very, very eminent chap. And it just sort of starts sitting in the pit lane and just what the driver is doing and how he or she manages to block out everything around them. And, you know, without going into sort of, you know, deep, abstruse biological terms, he explains what's going on in the brain and how the brain is functioning and how the brain readies itself for that challenge. And then there's the outlap and then there's the lap. I find it fascinating. Really did.
Yeah, it is a brilliant read. So a couple of other things I want to highlight. We have started a new series of features called Eyewitnessed. And we've published three or four of them now. I think it's four. And do you want to just briefly explain what Eyewitnessed is all about?
Yeah, well, we thought, didn't we, that we have such an amazing stable of writers waiting for us who have seen so much happen in all areas of motoring, be it the industry or the sport or whatever. And we sort of had a bit of a chat between us and we realised that so much had gone on, which we'd seen ourselves, which we'd actually been at. And so that's why we called it, it's a slightly sort of, you know, cheesy pun, but that's why we're calling it Eyewitnessed. Because, so these are stories by our own in-house contributors or ourselves of stuff that we actually saw ourselves with our own eyes. We didn't report upon it, we were there. And, you know, so it's not sort of secondhand. And it's a fascinating series. You know, I think it's what you're saying, it's just a nice idea. And I think it's, you know, more stuff that, you know, you're not going to get to read anywhere else.
Yeah, so the first one was Karun Chandok writing about Grosjean's crash in Bahrain, the Fireball crash. So he was there, he was in the paddock watching alongside Damon Hill. And it's, I mean, honestly, I still get shivers down my spine when I think back to that incident because it was so frightening, but then just so uplifting watching Grosjean leap out of that Fireball. And Chandok tells you what it was like to be there, which is a fairly extraordinary thing. We've also got David Tuig on what he calls Goan Day, which was when, in the late 90s, I believe, when Nissan was in dire financial straits. And Carlos Goan had come in. He'd spent months just sort of assessing, analysing the business. And in one video conference to 130,000-odd Nissan employees, he explained how he's going to turn it around. And that involved closing 5 plants, sadly cutting 26,000 jobs. So a very brutal day.
That's like firing everybody in a reasonably sized town in the UK.
It's a lot of people gone, isn't it?
Yeah.
But
it turned Nissan from a total basket case that nobody thought was going to survive, you know, into a massively profitable, you know, corporation, which, you know, and there's the alliance with Renault, and it's been, it was the most, one of the most amazing corporate turnarounds in, you know, automotive history.
Mm. Yeah. So that's Eyewitness. There are others and many more to come as well. Keep an eye on them. If you go to the website, you can actually select just Eyewitness articles. So you can see them all there in one place. Let's also talk about a piece Peter Robinson wrote called The Birth of the Quattro, which is fairly self-explanatory, isn't it? But he's gone to talk to a chap called Jörg Bensinger, who really is the father of the Quattro. It was him who first had this idea of inserting a four-wheel drive system into a high-performance road car. And he tells Robbo how it happened, working with Ferdinand Piëch, working with the designers and other engineers, how they brought this Quattro, this Audi Quattro, to life and built one of the iconic performance cars. It's a great tale.
Yeah, and also at the beginning, how it was all done without the knowledge of Volkswagen, which was ultimately paying for it. It was a sort of, you know, undercover skunk works weekend project that turned into the most, well, iconic and important sports car of its decade.
And it's an insight into Ferdinand Piëch as well, isn't it? A titan of the car industry, an extraordinary character, and this reveals a fair amount about him. Okay, the last one I want to talk about, and actually I want to talk about this car as well, because the embargo's lifted, we can talk about it. You can tell us all about the Ferrari Daytona SP3.
Yeah, full review on the website now. It's a different sort of car. It is a car, I think, ultimately, that, you know, it's not like this is Ferrari's next LaFerrari or Enzo, which were, you know, sort of ultimate performance car. It's massively expensive. It's €2 million. And they've made, what, 599, and they're all sold and blah. It's probably, even though it is powered by the most powerful V12 engine Ferrari have ever produced and put into either a road car or indeed a racing car, because I look back to the outputs of the Formula One 3.5 litre and they didn't have 829 horsepower. It's one of those cars where the driving experience is great, but it's not about how fast you can go. It's about the purity of the driving experience and the way the thing looks. And I drove it on the roads around Le Mans at the time of the Le Mans Classic, and I've never received more attention driving anything anywhere in my entire life. It was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, the car looks incredible, and I'm not going to bang on about appearances on this podcast because I'm no better judge of them than anybody else. But it was, I was very struck by the attention that it got, and I think that's why people buy those sorts of cars. You know, basically, it's the tub of a LaFerrari modified to take the engine of an 812 Competizione in a carbon fibre body, which is absolutely gorgeous. You know, what's not to like? Well, it costs $2 million and you can't have one. But other than that, fascinating car. I still think that there is room for Ferrari to do its, what is McLaren F1, a super light, just to show what can be done, pure driving machine. I think that car is still out there. Maybe that's what the SP4 will be like. I have no idea. But, you know, amazing thing to go and do, amazing car to go and drive.
Let's just talk briefly about this Icona series, because they are relatively likely re-engineered versions of existing Ferraris, built in strictly limited numbers with eye-watering seven-figure price tags. So they generate, well, this, how many SP3s are they building? It's 499,
Five, 599. So that's 99 more or 100 more than they made LaFerraris. And, okay, yeah, there's been a bit of inflation, but it cost basically twice as much.
Yeah.
and it doesn't have a hybrid system, and it's still using a LaFerrari tab. Yeah.
That is amazing. And it's going to generate,
and they're all pre-sold. They all just went.
Yeah, and it will generate €1 billion in revenue for a car that had basically already been engineered.
Yeah, good business if you can get it. And there will be people who are thinking it's a ridiculous car. It's, you know, how could you possibly spend that amount of money on it? What, you know, it's just stupid. But, you know, QED, people want them. Mm. There are, you know, Ferrari found 599. And I suspect there were rather more. People who wanted that. And you cannot blame a car manufacturer for building the cars its customers want. That's their business. You know, they've got shareholders who they're accountable to. you know, you might not be as impressed with it as something, you know, more mainstream, which has got all sorts of other challenges to face and to overcome. But what you can't say, I don't think, is that it's a waste of money, because by definition, it's not, because they have found that amount of people to spend that money on.
It's extraordinary business. Yeah, fair play to Ferrari. Okay, that's the Daytona SP3. You can read Andrew's full review. It's a beautifully written piece, a long one as well. I think it's 2,500 words or something. It's on the app. It's on the website, the-intercooler.com. Go and have a look. Okay, right, so we said this episode was going to be about £20,000 cars, and just sort of looking at how much interesting stuff you can actually buy for 20 grand or less. So let's get stuck into it.
I think we should be doing more of this stuff. I mean, it's fine me, you know, waxing lyrical about £2 million Ferraris and that sort of thing, but actually, this stuff interests me more. I mean, I spent a terrifying amount of time just going through classifieds and just gazing over the stuff and thinking, you know, because I probably could, if I wanted, I could probably go and spend £20,000 on a car. And so it then comes down to, is it a good idea? What are you going to do with it? Where are you going to keep it? Who's going to look after it? This is kind of heartland for me. And I suspect it is for an awful lot of people listening to this.
Yeah, I've found it really enjoyable searching through. And it's amazing what you can get for that money. However, some of the cars I've pulled out, their potential to present you with an enormous, comfortably five-figure bill is fairly extraordinary. So it might be that this is, you know, if you have £30,000 or £40,000 to spend on a car, spend half that and keep some in reserve. Because I suspect if you sink all of your cash or you borrow a load of money to buy one of the cars on my list, sadly, you will just be worried the whole time, or a bill will come in, and just like that, all the enjoyment of, I don't know, having some exotic car or something with a beautiful engine, that enjoyment has gone, hasn't it?
Yeah, and also, you know, having to explain to your other half why you're £6,000 poorer than you were this morning. I've done that. It's not much fun.
Okay. Well, should we... Let's start in the sort of more sensible end of the spectrum here. What hot hatch have you pulled out?
Oh, I'm going to be so boring and predictable. You know exactly what I'm going to say. It's a late Golf Mark 7 GTI, or it's a 2015, 2016 Civic Type R. Depending on what, if you want to drive, get the Civic. If you want something to do everything, get the Golf. I mean, to me, that is an absolute slam dunk no-brainer. And actually, possibly unlike you, I've tried to keep my choices slightly real world.
I've gone the other way.
If you buy very carefully, you stand a reasonable chance of not having a nightmare.
This is how we should do it. When we do this in future, one of us should be vaguely sensible.
Captain Sensible, yeah.
The other one should just be out there. Just to kind of demonstrate.
I'll be Captain Sensible because I'm 20 years older than you.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm going to spend £17,000 on a 2004 Alfa Romeo 147 GTA.
Oh! What could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly? 56,000 miles. It's had... Yeah, the one I've... there are quite a few out there for under 20 grand, actually. This one's had a little bit of modifications. Polybush, Bilstein coilovers. Now, and it's got a Quaife diff. I've actually not driven one of these. I know you will have done. Are they basically fairly terrible apart from the engine?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's something. I mean, and the point being fairly, they're not awful. They're not absolutely ghastly. Yeah. But terrible is probably... They are... I'm about to say slightly disappointing, but expectations weren't that high, to be honest with you. They are... Yeah, they're just a bit rubbish, apart from the engine.
But what an engine.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a great choice, but... Yeah, so rather you than me, mate.
They have that wonderful 3.2 Alfa V6, about 250 horsepower. Very pretty-looking engine and a very pretty-looking car. Perhaps not the last word in dynamics. Well, what about then, just as an alternative, A Mark 1 Focus RS.
Yes. All day long. Good call.
So a lot of them have been modified now, which seems a pity.
That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's finding a good one.
This one is, I believe it's standard. Well serviced, lots of history. Does look really good. 77,000 miles, 19 grand. I think they look so cool. I'm not sure there's a better looking hot hatch than that.
But also, they were fantastic to drive.
Yeah.
And also, I haven't heard, you know, too many horror stories about them. I would probably try, and even if you went to, had to go to, I don't know, 22, 23, I'd probably try to get one that's done slightly fewer miles than that, but maybe it would probably be all right at 77. You know, and I also think that that is possibly unlike your 147 GTA. I think that that is a car which will look after you over time. I can't see those cars ever being low. If they're good cars, if they're good examples, and that is the crucial thing with these, is you've got to get good examples because they are so rare. And people, you know, ultimately, the market always does this, doesn't it? You know, you look at, I don't know, 205 GTIs or whatever, look at the cars that are getting proper money now. They're all the ones which haven't been messed about.
Yeah.
And because so many have, you know, that makes your car not only sort of proper and authentic, but rare as well. And that's where the market always ends up going. So if you're going to do something like that, don't buy some whizzed up thing which has been, you know, slammed and the power turned up to 11. Just get a nice... Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing is that when people tune these cars, I'm sure some of them do it very well, but ultimately, you know, some very clever people with an awful lot of resources made that car as good as they possibly could from the start. And it's not often that, you know, some bloke with a smart idea can actually improve on those standards. You know, I found this one. I bought a 205 GTR, which had been lightly modded, and everything I took off it made the car better. Everything I did to it to turn it back to what it was improved the car. And I don't think that's a rare experience at all. So yeah, good call. Focus Mark 1 RS.
Yeah. Okay. All right. What are you spending your 20 grand budget on for on a family car? Which way is that going?
I'm being slight. I'm not being entirely sensible here.
Good.
But I just couldn't resist it. E90 M3.
Ah. Yeah. Very interesting. Not sensible. Cool car, though.
Cool car. And, you know, I might be stretching the family thing a bit, but, you know, there's quite a lot of room in the back of those.
Yeah.
For, you know, a young kid or two. Decent sized boot. Okay, I'm buying an engine, aren't I? I'm buying an engine with a car thrown in, free of charge. But, that 4-litre V8 is just absolutely monstrous. And, again, you'd have to buy so carefully, wouldn't you? And you'd have to really check through the history, and you'd have to know all about the foibles with those cars, which they have. But, funnily enough, when they were new, I wasn't that knocked out of them by them, because I guess they'd followed the E46, which was and remains... the icon. I suspect you've got an E46 on your list, or you would have thought about it, because that's the kind of obvious choice, isn't it? But I was trying to, having come up with the Golf GTI, thinking, well, for this next one, it won't be entirely obvious. And I just thought, I don't know, you can get a slightly newer car. There's just as more of a sort of classic fun thing to have rather than a sort of daily driver. Smoking around in an E90, maybe literally smoking around in an E90, just struck me as being a fun thing to do.
Absolutely. Okay, I've got a couple of family car options. Not entirely sensible, but 16 and a half grand on an early, so it's a 2009 Porsche Panamera V8, four-wheel drive. Brave.
You can get them for that, can you?
Yeah. I was amazed. 16 and a half. 93,000 miles.
Fair
done play. A bit of distance. But that's a 400 horsepower V8. Do you know what? On the launch, I remember driving a rear drive manual V8 Panamera. But they clearly sold about four, because you just can't find one anywhere. But that would be a hell of a car. Even this would be a hell of a car. Four wheel drive, PDK, V8.
I just want a turbo. If I was going to go down that road, I just wanted to, because I can just remember how bonkers those cars are. Yeah. I can remember doing a twin test with that and an Aston Rapide. Aston didn't see which way it went.
Yeah, it wouldn't.
Yeah.
I do wonder how the Panamera is aging. Do you think it would still feel good inside? Do you think it would still be quiet and ride well and feel robust? It should do, shouldn't it?
I don't think they ever rode that well, did they? Yeah, I think it would still feel robust. Yeah. I think it'll still be hideously ugly as well.
Well, yeah, there is that.
Yeah, no, I think it would be, again, get a nice one. I think it'd be fine. I think that's quite a good left field choice, actually.
Yeah. Okay, I've got one more. And this is actually less appealing to me than the Panamera. Mercedes CLS C63 AMG. So it's got that stonking 6.2 AMG engine. They call it a coupe. It's not a coupe. It's a four-door saloon, really, isn't it? But it's that sleek, elegant-looking thing with a storming V8. I just quite fancy.
Yeah, again, if I was going to get one of those, I'd get the shooting brake. If you could find one. The CLS shooting brake was just one of those weird things. Basically, what you get is you get the style of a CLS with the practicality of an E-Class wagon.
Mm.
And when it came out, I just thought, well, this thing's going to take over the world because it's just the best of both worlds. It looks amazing. It's got huge amounts of space in it. They're going to sell billions. It tanked.
Yeah.
Which just goes to show how much I know about stuff. They couldn't shift them for love nor money, and they canned it. I just thought it was... Actually, I ran a diesel as a long-termer for Autocar years back and absolutely loved it. And if I was going to go down that road, if I could find one, I'd get a wagon because I think it's at least as good looking at the coupe, possibly better, and just so much more usable. But I think I'm thinking too much with my sort of, you know, practical, what do you do with it rather than what it looks like kind of head on. And I guess there are people who just don't like the idea of, you know, a wagon where they can have a coupe. And I also think it works the other way because, you know, on the one hand, yes, it is, you know, a car which looks like a coupe and has got practical space like a wagon. You could also say it's got less space in it than the wagon, which it does, and it's priced like the coupe. So I don't know, but I'd definitely get a shooting brake if I was going to get one of those. But yeah, good call. That actually does slightly scupper me on one of the later categories because I do have another car which might have the same engine in it.
Oh, good. Well, I thought we might do. I mean, I just had to find something with that engine in. My list would have been incomplete without that engine. Okay. Okay, do you want to choose a category?
Well, can we do estate cars? Because that's where my
C63
comes in.
Yeah, okay. There you go. Yeah, I'm into that.
So you can get an early C63, which will have the 6.2 in it. Not particularly... grunty version of it, but still, you know, 457 horsepower in a C-Class. I mean, I can remember at the time, the only problem with those things is they got a fuel tank designed for a 2-litre diesel engine. So basically, you're stopping every 10 minutes to drop another load of petrol in it, which, you know, the prices they are today is probably not going to be an awful lot of fun. But great looking car, really good fun to drive, awesome, stonking engine. You know, of those cars of that era, you know, the A4 Avant, the 3 Series Touring, the C-Class was far and away the most practical, had the most space in it,
really?
Biggest boot. Yeah. So you can actually use it. I mean, it's not like an E-Class, it's not a, or a Volvo, it's not some cavernous, you know, thing, but it's a really, really good family hack. When they came out, I absolutely adored those. And I bet it would still stack up.
Yeah, that's very cool. I'd be tempted by one of those. Okay, I don't have an estate car, so I'm going to move it on to coupes. We did an episode all about Maserati last week, and we mentioned the Gran Turismo. Neither of us particularly like that car. But when you see one for 18 grand with 39,000 miles...
I still don't want it.
And it looks fantastic. And it's a Maserati. And it's got it's got that brilliant V8 engine. And you still don't want it. No, I know, that's fair enough. But I can imagine thoroughly enjoying...
Okay. If they gave it to you, okay, it cost you nothing at all, okay, but they gave it to you on condition that you couldn't sell it and just take the money, okay, would you want it?
Yes. If it's free...
Yeah, I know it's free, but it's still a slightly... Would you not just be thinking, there are so many other cars that are better than this? Would it not just annoy you every time you got into it?
Well, this is what I'm intrigued by, because I think I could enjoy it and not care that it was a bit baggy, not care that the gearbox was a bit rubbish, not care that it felt a little bit flaky, because I'm in a V8 Maserati, and I think
It would annoy me every time.
Really?
It's one of those cars where I would drive it, and actually I'd be completely unfair on it, because I wouldn't be thinking about it. I would just be, you know, I would be focusing on all the things that it did wrong, and I wouldn't be focusing on the things that it got right, which is totally unfair, but it would just be, with a car like that, the way my mind would work.
The potential for a Gran Turismo to just ruin your life with a terrible bill is fairly large. It just would happen. So this particular car, in 2018 alone, had more than £9,000 spent on it. Presumably all stuff that needed doing. And this one...
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
Yeah. The vendor is very honest, apparently. Two bad points. Suspension light is on. At the start, it is a little stiff. Then after a little drive, it comes back to normal, but the light stays on. So that's a big problem.
Run! As fast as you can, in the other direction.
The other issue is that the media player has issues, as it just says the Maserati logo. That's all it does.
It sounds like it might need a code or something. That might be quite an easy fix. Or it might not be.
Who knows?
Well, I wouldn't want to find out.
No. So, yeah, okay, I didn't think I'd be able to persuade you on that one. But, honestly, I look at them and I just think, they're so cool.
Okay, if I was going to have a coupe... I wouldn't even need to spend £20,000 or anything close to it. I'd get a 370Z Nissan.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Tough?
Tough, fun, slides, sideways, cracking V6 motor. I like the way they look. Not a Cayman, but a fraction of the price of a Cayman. And not a fraction of the fun.
Mm. I wonder if you could get a Nismo. Are they down to that? They might be.
Don't know, didn't look it up.
I think they arrived a good 10 years ago, so probably. And they were good to drive. Yeah. They were fantastic to drive. Okay, I want a sports car now. I'm going to offer you a sports car. And I think I have to confess that I'm probably 6 months, maybe a year early to these. Because on all of Auto Trader, there are two F-types below 20 grand. One was some sort of write-off. But this one, 56,000 miles, it's the baby V6, so the lower powered V6, which is still, what is that? It's still 340 horsepower. It's a coupe, and it's got service history. Slightly concerning, there's only one key, and it's had more than five owners, and the wheels need a refurb. So this is...
Well, okay, that just means the car's not been looked after, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
If the wheels need refurb, that means it's been bounced off curb. People haven't cared about it. Load of owners, and the key's gone missing at some stage.
Yeah. So I think give it 6 months, give it a year, and hopefully there'll be better cared for examples just starting to dip under that 20 grand barrier. But and you'd ideally want the V6S, which had a bit more power. But 20 grand F-type, I don't think they're quite there yet, but they're getting there. That's an interesting car, isn't it?
But what do you pay for an early DB9? Probably not much more than that, is it?
Probably not, but its bill potential would be far greater. I'd rather have the Jag.
I'd have the Aston. 6-litre V12 engine, looks.
I know. Yeah. I like the Jag, though. I think they're good to drive. They look great. They're not quite there yet, but they're not too far off. Okay. Right.
Can I do a slightly different one?
You can, and then I'm going to give you riskiest one of all.
Okay, so I'm starting to get... I mean, I'm glad I've got a Caterham tucked away, because otherwise I might have to do something about this. I'm starting to get a serious thing about Series 1 Elises. I just think they're fantastic. I just think they are. I drove one recently. In fact, when they made the last Elise... I went and drove the first and the last. So I drove an original, absolutely bog standard, 118 horsepower K-series Elise, and the last of the last, whatever they called that, ran out Cup Series thing. I couldn't believe how close, just in terms of the enjoyment it gave. And in many ways, in some ways, it was actually more enjoyable because it was, you know, obviously that much lighter and purer and everything else. But it just made me realise, you know, however good we thought it was in whenever it came out, 96, 97, actually, it's even more extraordinary now. I mean, they just... What is it about them? It's just the way they feel. They are such thoroughbred cars. They are so pure in the way they respond to you. You just get in it and you just feel instantly at home. You are so aware that you are driving something really, really special. And again, you know, Captain Sensible here. I have been thinking about, you know, long-term values and maintenance costs and that sort of thing. They don't cost much to run. And, you know, you can buy, you know, a nice Series 1 of these for less than £20,000 now. I can't see it ever being worth less than that. I think they're cracking buys. And as I say, I'm very glad I got the Caterham, because otherwise, I think I'd go and do it.
And let's not forget that their S1 Elise is a Julian Thompson design. The F-Type, we've been talking about, is a Callum design, Ian Callum. Both of those
Is a DB9.
As is a DB9. And both of those guys are now part of the TI writing team. That's good. Yep. That makes me feel proud. Okay, so as a counterpoint to your Series 1 Elise. We'll call them lightweight sports cars. There's... 20 grand doesn't actually go that far on a Caterham these days.
No.
Not really.
I can tell you that from your experience.
You can. So instead, I looked at Westfield. And I found one particularly intriguing car, an S8 2004, with a V8 in it. And I wondered, what on earth is that V8?
It's a Rover V8. Know.
Exactly, it is a Rover V8.
I do know. I fell out with Westfield when I was a young lad because I drove one of their cars and said something not particularly complimentary about it. And I was Silverstone, something like that, doing something, and they were there and they came up to me and someone told me that I was never going to drive a Westfield again. And actually, they were completely right because I haven't. We did have a V8 Westfield in on test. It caught fire.
Good.
I wasn't in it at the time, but there was a carb fire. I mean, not a serious thing. The car didn't burn out, but I think it certainly got the attention of the driver. Mm. I just don't know enough about Westfield. I know that, you know, when I was driving them, which was 30 years ago, they just weren't as good as Caterhams. And I don't really know, because I literally haven't driven one since, whether that's a smart idea or not. It might be. I mean, you know, think about it. You know, small, light, you know, massive alloy V8 engine in it. It would be interesting.
It would. I was intrigued by it because, I mean, really, that is the wrong engine, isn't it, for a little lightweight 7-type car? Because you want something smaller and really picky and buzzy, like a Revy 4-pot. Don't you ideally...
Yeah.
But I was...
Yeah, but you probably do. Because I think, actually, if you're going to go down that road, you just get a TVR, wouldn't you? And you could probably get a Chimera, couldn't you? You probably get a 4-litre Chimera for 20 grand.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad shot.
Comfortably.
Because the thing about TVRs is, you know, these days, cars like that, you know, before they put the ridiculous Al Melling engine in them, is that, you know, they probably weren't that well built at the time. But what that means is that everything that was going to fall off and will have fallen off them by now and been put back by someone who knew what they were doing. So actually, although when I last drove one, I was amazed by how old it felt. It felt vintage. Yeah. It felt closer to an Austin Healey than a modern car. Mm. But for a certain sort of person and for a certain sort of, you know, not particularly demanding drive, great fun. Why am I talking about TVRs? Well, because I haven't driven a Westfield, that's why. So, and you asked about the engine and that sort of thing. And that V8, which is exactly the same motor, works so brilliantly well in a TVR. Every time you drive a TVR, which doesn't have that engine in it, you kind of find yourself thinking, well, I'd just rather have this big, lazy Buick V8 in it. So actually, you know, having thought about it, a 4-litre Chimera, because I don't think you'd get a 500 or a 4.3, but an early Chimera would be, and you wouldn't get a Griff, I don't think, but, you know, that'd be a good shot.
Mm. Okay, let me give you one more, which is Total Fantasy Land, which has got build potential like few other cars on the used market.
More than a Gran Turismo Maserati?
I think so. and you can buy them far cheaper.
Do you know
than
what? This, so just before you do, can we do another podcast of just cars you shouldn't buy? Wonderful
yes.
cars, which are going to get you into so much trouble.
Yeah, you know, so we can do that.
Sort of, I don't know, fire sale Lamborghini Countach. Or yeah, yeah, just think how what car is going to give you more grief? What car are you going to regret buying more than any other in the whole wide world? We'll just do a podcast about them.
We should. I mean, but the thing, people do buy these cars. Someone buys them, and some people must have a good experience doing it.
Yes,
potentially. I don't know.
Yes, you always get the lucky ones, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. There'll be some out there, but you just won't know who. You won't know which car is the lucky one, will you?
So yeah, I did 50,000 miles on my fire-damaged Countach. It never went right. It's not a conversation you have very often, but you know, I'm not
I've
saying
not
it's
heard
never
that
happened.
One. Okay, so you can get them cheaper than this, but I've tried to find one that looks fairly sensible, that hasn't done too many miles. And actually, it's very easy to find early flying Spuds for under 20 grand. Bentley
it's
flying Spuds.
Do you know, I think that's a great, I've never heard of the flying Spud before.
But I'd rather have a Continental GT.
I don't think that's silly at all. I think that's a great idea.
So I found
one. I think that's a fantastic idea.
A fiver short of 20 grand. It's done 57,000 miles. Of course it is the W12 because it's an early car. But that would be pretty special, wouldn't it?
Oh, do you know what? I can remember doing a group test. It was a second-hand group test thing that I did for Autocar. And what did we have down there? We had a Lamborghini Gallardo. We had something else Italian. It might have been a Ferrari. Anyway, we had a load of cars. And there was going to be a Continental GT there. And at the last moment, whoever it was who was supplying this Continental GT rang up and said, oh, I'm terribly sorry, we just sold the car. And I went, you bastard, you know, you're meant to be here with the car now. Have you got anything else? And they went, well, no, we haven't. You've got no Continental. They said, we've got one, but it's just coming in. It's a complete mess. And I said, we'll have it. Mm. And he said, well, this car's coming in. It's done a bazillion miles. It's bounced off every curb in London because the wheels are ruined. I can't vouch for it at all. I know nothing about it at all. And I said, look, you know, we haven't got a story unless you bring it down. So we turned up in this thing. It looked, I think we could only photograph it from one side because it has such a horrible life. It drove beautifully. It just felt so much tighter and taut and together than anything else we had there. And you know, there's probably nothing else which makes me realise just how well built those cars are. Mm. They're just, I was about to say bomb-proof, clearly they're not. And I'm not saying for a moment you couldn't get a terrifying bill out of one of them. But I just thought, actually, if I was going to get one of these cars, that's what I would get, just because I'd back it more, I'd worry about it less than anything else that kind of money would buy when you're talking about that kind of car.
Because there's a lot of VW underneath. A lot.
Well, an enormous amount, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. It should be okay. But I've done a little bit of reading up on them. And one of the buying guides I read said that head gaskets shouldn't fail, but they have been known to. And the trouble is, with this engine, that is an engine out job. And this particular buying guide puts the bill at potentially 15 grand, which is almost the value of the car itself.
Yeah, I can write off the car. But when they say, you know, head gaskets have been known to go, I mean, there's not a car in the world who hasn't had a head gasket that's been known to go. So what you need to know is whether that's a problem or not, whether that is a known problem, whether it's like a, you know, an intermediate shaft on a 996. You know, if it's a known problem and basically it's going to happen, then you need to factor that if it's something which, or you know, has happened, you know, to an unspecified number of cars. You know, let's face it. You know, they were making, you know, certain years they were making 10,000 of these cars a year. So they, I mean, they're probably a, you know, between 100,000 and 200,000 cars out there. If it's happened to three of them, you're probably going to be okay, aren't you?
Hmm. Yeah,
so that's what you need to know.
Quite right. Yeah, just a little bit of research will make all the difference, won't it? But that is an awful
lot of
car.
I mean, what will be expensive is just basic maintenance. You know, you need a new set of discs and pads. That's going to be a lot of money. You need a new exhaust. That's going to be a lot of money. That sort of thing's going to cost. Mm. But as you say, there's so much Volkswagen engineering in them. And because they're Bentley built, they're built to a fantastically high standard. Yeah, I think, you know what, I think, and also, you know, they're good cars for their era. You know, they don't handle brilliantly well because the weight's in the wrong place, but they're, you know, very fast. You know, 550 horsepower if you just get the standard car. I think they look great. Dirk van Breickel was the designer of that. And, yeah, beautifully put together. I mean, nothing like as ridiculous a choice as a Gran Turismo as Maserati in my book.
Good. Well, there we go. Maybe I'll have to do it after all. So, the 20 grand cars. Be interested to know what you all think of a which way your 20 grand would go. But we'll do it again. We'll pick a different price point. We won't go bananas with the price point, but we'll pick something else. And, yeah, we'll both go and hunt out some intriguing buys for that budget. It's good fun, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for listening, everybody. Thank you to JBR Capital for sponsoring the podcast. Please go and check out JBR Capital if you're looking to buy a used car or a new car. Let's see what they can do for you on the finance side. There'll be contact details in the description below. Please also rate and review the podcast. Rate and review the podcast, please. I'm going to keep banging that drum because it's really important. That's how we find new listeners. And please also subscribe and follow wherever you listen to the podcast. And actually, we're not going to do a listener question this week because it's been a very packed episode. We'll bring We'll bring it back next week. I promise.
All right, promise.
But there we go. Yeah, I do. And thanks for listening. We will be back next week with a listener question, I promise.
Look forward to it.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.